You are listening to Making Bank, where we uncover the mindset and success strategies of the top 1% so you can amplify your life and your business.
Welcome to Making Bank. I am Josh Felber, where we uncover the mindset and the success strategies of the top 1% so you can amplify your life and your business today. Super excited and honored for today's guest. He's an award-winning researcher and Wharton professor. Ethan Mollick has spent his career with and studying startups, especially given our new global reality, appreciates and understands their value even more. He knows firsthand how radically a successful startup can improve a founder's socioeconomic status, how even dire circumstances can breed remarkable, innovative ideas, and how entrepreneurs are often the most nimble and capable at solving problems during a crisis like this right now that we're experiencing. Mollick has made it his mission to democratize entrepreneurship and by championing an evidence-based revolution in the study of the field, bust the myths that exist around startups in an effort to encourage a more diverse group of people to join the field of entrepreneurship. In his new book, The Unicorn Shadow, Combating the Dangerous Myths That Hold Back Startups, Founders, and Investors, that is out now, Mollick for the first time reveals the latest scientific findings, his own and his peers on startups in the form of an accessible, concise, and valuable book for all budding entrepreneurs and the people who watch them closely. So I'm super excited today to welcome Ethan to Making Bank.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
For sure, man. Excited to dive into what you guys got in the book. But let's first, I kind of want to dive into your background a little bit, because obviously we talked about you've been working with startups and diving in and trying to understand the ins and outs and all the craziness of them. So give us a little bit of that background.
Sure. So I started in the entrepreneur path myself, a college roommate, and I joined together, started a company that was one of the inventors of the paywall. So you have us to thank for the fact that you have to pay to get access to every newspaper in the late 90s, the first internet boom. And I did everything wrong. My partner did better. I did everything wrong and decided I was going to get an MBA and learn how to do it right. And then in my MBA, I realized nobody really knew the answer. So I've since spent the time studying, advising, teaching. So I've taught thousands of entrepreneurs. I do research on the topic. I work with some of the smartest people in the field and wrote this really short book. It's less than 100 pages to try and kind of summarize some of the latest academic work, because I often think there's a big gap between what people know and what people think they know.
No, I think that's definitely true. And obviously, you're a teacher and everything else as well. And a lot of people are in school and they're trying to learn entrepreneurship and, you know, how to start a business and do it all. But like you said, there's that gap of actual real world experience to that classroom experience. And, you know, I'd love to kind of have you touch on that a little bit.
That's great. I mean, it's actually a two-way gap, right? So part of that is, you know, theory to practice, as you know, and from all your shows, right, that doing it is very different than just learning about it. But the other way goes too, right? It turns out we can teach people to be better entrepreneurs. It's one of my, like, one of the passions here is we actually have really strong evidence that if you teach people how to do experiments as a founder, how to pitch, they actually get better. So like a study out of Italy just found that if you teach people how to do experiments and test their ideas in a rational kind of scientific way, revenues were up twice for those companies compared to companies that weren't taught that method a year later. So it's a two-way mission, right? On one hand, to acknowledge that you can't learn everything in the schoolhouse, but on the other to say, hey, we learned some things now in the last 10 years about entrepreneurship yeah. that I really want people to know about. And I feel that the message is often lost.
For sure. And no, and that's interesting because like you said, I mean, I started when I was 14 as an entrepreneur and have owned multiple businesses over the years. And I mean, that was always the thing. It was like, you just don't go to school to be an entrepreneur. It's you learn it, you do it, you're in it. Yeah. But I think that's fascinating, the fact that some of the different things that you guys are now discovering and utilizing and implementing in startups, you know, are coming from the other side of it. And so, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no. I was just going to say, I mean, I think that it's really powerful to have the experience and to be able to share it, the advantage that I can bring to the table, you know, and I've been through this myself too, I advise companies, but it's that idea of like, okay, what does the dispassionate numbers say? Right. And I can't necessarily tell you how to be a giant success, right? There's a magic of hustle and other stuff that we know is there.
Right.
But I can tell you how to avoid common pitfalls. And I can tell you that a lot of what people think is necessary for success may not actually be when we look at the numbers.
Great. What, I guess, through what you're finding out then, what are some of these common pitfalls that you guys are seeing that we can avoid?
So a lot of them are just kind of myths we have about who needs to be there to found a company, right? So whether that's the belief that you should, that you, younger people are better founders, right? Turns out not to be true. I don't know if you've shared on your show before, but the average age of a founder in the United States, we now have a really good data by Danny Kim, Pierre Zule, a bunch of other people looked at all the census data for every startup. Average age for a founder is 42.
Wow.
Average age for a founder who gets venture capital, 42. Average age for a founder who starts a company that creates hypergrowth, that's at the 0.01% fastest growing companies in America, 45 to 59. So there's a little bit of like this view that it's a young person who's doing this, not always true, right? Similarly, I've got research showing that solo founders often outperform teams. We have a lot of research that looks at personality and entrepreneurship, and it finds out that there's no one type that's an entrepreneur type. So there's a lot of kind of interesting angles where I think we believe certain things that turn out not to actually match what the data says.
No, that's interesting. And I'm glad I'm in that 45 to 49 group.
people are either happy about it, but at least if you're not happy, you can wait, and you're like, your greatest days are still ahead of you, right?
So right.
Younger groups are like, yeah. And when I teach younger groups,
I'm like, all right, we got a lot coming on then.
Yeah, we still got time.
Well, and that's one of the things too you mentioned, I think, was everybody kind of thinks like, oh, this is your stereotypical entrepreneur personality, or, you know, they're this type A and they have this drive and no sleep and 80 hours a week. I mean, what are you guys kind of uncovering in that? Because it's interesting.
So just to dive into no sleep, turns out that is the worst idea. Okay. And actually, there's been like 5 papers on why no sleep is terrible. Okay. So first of all, when founders don't sleep, a couple of weird things happen. First of all, they get worse ideas. They become less creative, but they also become more impulsive. So they act on bad ideas more. So what ends up happening is if you're chronically sleep deprived, you're more likely to start a company, but it's more likely to be a bad company. Also, when founders don't sleep, they're in a bad mood. And that actually influences their entire company because it turns out emotions are contagious among founders. So if they come in cranky and tired, it makes everybody cranky. And then idea quality in the entire company plummets. So and then on top of that all, it's just stress and recovery. You need that moment. There are moments where you can't sleep as a founder. There's moments where it's all in. You know, we've all been there where you have to stay up all night, 3 nights in a row before the big product launch or your big pitch or whatever it is. And if you don't have the reserves for that, then those moments tend to break founders. Mm. So making that the exception rather than the rule turns out to be a really good thing. And similarly, we find that founders of families actually get buffered from some of the stress of founding. They have some other area in their life. So, you know, talking about having a strong life and a strong family life and balancing that with a strong entrepreneurship urge, really powerful.
That's awesome. And that's, I mean, that's obviously, if you're on my website, that's kind of what we talked about is family and faith and entrepreneurship. And so kind of like, you know, it's that family piece that helps with, you know, give you kind of that whole, I guess that makes you a better entrepreneur, I could say. And that was interesting what you talked, though, about, you know, with sleep and kind of where that mindset is. Because obviously, as a founder and getting the sleep and recovering, as you mentioned as well, I think is huge. And I think that's been making a big shift over the last couple of years. You know, yeah, you're hustling, you're pushing hard and everything else, but you also got to get your sleep or recover, I guess, kind of umbrella, you know, sleep, recovery, and taking the time to manage your stress levels and everything, I think is significantly huge. And what was kind of interesting, I was thinking about it when you were saying is you come up with bad ideas and then you, and then you execute on them or they get worse or something. You're so, I'm like, wait, you come with the bad idea and now you're executing on the bad idea. And then it's just, you know, it's a whole kind of process.
Exactly. And then you get, and you commit to those bad ideas. And because you're not thinking straight, you double down and you can't make them successful. And it creates a spiral. So, I mean, one of the messages I've been giving to venture capitalists every time I talk to them is stop judging people based on the hours worked. That's a really bad technique because not all hours are equally productive and encourages people to burn out. And then also you model that for your employees, right? So then your employees are all burning out. And, you know, it's, you could do that for a little while, but you just can't keep it going forever.
And so what do you guys, what have you found through the research and everything and working with all the different startups from, you know, here's the different things that are really making companies successful. Obviously they don't all have to be the unicorns, but you know, what are these processes or what are these different things that are really making companies successful or founders successful in the companies?
So I don't know if you've typically talked about things like lean startups or other kinds of approaches like that.
Sure.
So if, for those who haven't heard, and I'm not sure if everyone would have, so I don't have to talk about it. But if you haven't, a lean startup is a method that came out of Silicon Valley that you're basically going to experiment with customers and products as a founder, and you're not really going to start building anything until you find demand. So what we've been finding is that there's some really good ideas in that, right? And the most important idea from that that seems to work is what I said, experimentation. So it turns out that founders who really sit down and figure out what do I not know about the world that I need to know, what has to be true about the universe, about the world for my business to succeed, and then how do I test those things out in a coherent way before I leap, do much better.
Okay.
So that idea of experimentation, of testing, it doesn't mean you're not hustling. You're absolutely hustling. You're out there pushing, but you know why you're pushing, and you're not just doing anything random. You're deciding what do I need to know most, and what kind of experiment can I design to figure out whether that is, you know, is going to happen or not. So that might be that I need to know more about, you know, like my customer's willingness to pay turns out to be the really big deal. Mm. So what experiments can I design with customers or with interviews or with surveys to understand whether they're willing to pay? Because I need to knock down the biggest issue first before I move on to the next one.
Sure.
And a lot of founders are inclined to do, you know, to just sort of do everything at once. Another big thing, I told you that personality doesn't predict founder success.
Right.
It does predict the chance of entering entrepreneurship. You know what the biggest personality trait that predicts someone becoming an entrepreneur is? Overconfidence.
Wow.
So overconfidence,
okay.
Which it makes sense, right?
Yeah.
If you don't think you can do it, you don't have to, like you're not going to do it because the odds are against you.
Right.
So it's like being in a rock band or deciding to be an actor. You need to think you're amazing. Some of you are amazing. All of you listening to this are amazing, but not everybody is going to make it, right? So overconfidence means that founders are often blind to negative things. They don't change unless they have tests and experiments because they just view every obstacle as something they overcome. But sometimes an obstacle suggests that you should change direction. So
right.
Some of the most powerful research that we have that's really clear is you need to be engaging in experiments. You need to know what you're testing about your business at all times. And you need to constantly be thinking about the tests that are actually giving the results and making sure that you're not being fooled by your overconfidence.
I like that because I know, so I've had 50 companies since I was 14, but wow. One of the biggest things for me was every time I would do a venture or a startup, I didn't worry about, oh, is this going to fail? Or, oh, is this not going to work out? I just went after it. Like, oh, we'll figure it out. We got this. And just kind of always pushed through. And I would say most of the time it was really good. And there was some times that you're like, all right, I probably shouldn't have continued with that, like you said.
Right. And I mean, the drive, and I will say, like, again, for the really extraordinary, like, it's hard for me to tell you, just like you were saying before, about the 1% success, right?
Sure.
Like, you know, there's some rule breaking, there's some luck, there's some personality that can be extraordinary. But when I'm talking to a large group of people, right, who haven't necessarily run 50 companies, I think this is really important, you know, like, once you've built the gut feel for it, maybe it's a little different, right? We can't tell because I can look at thousands of startups, but I can't tell you one, right? So that's sort of the research we do.
Super cool. So kind of dive into your book here a little bit. Obviously you're taking a lot of your scientific research and everything that you guys have been learning, and you created a short book, you said, so it makes it an easy read for somebody that's looking to dive into this. So give us a little bit of insights into what you got here.
Yeah, I mean, back when we had airplanes, the idea was to fly on an airplane, to read on an airplane flight, right? So now I guess it's during your afternoon quarantine, you have a chance to read it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's short and, you know, packed with references you don't have to read. So that's good. But it makes you feel sciencey. It is sciencey, but, quasi-academic-y. But I think so the chapters cover how to founding teams, right, which we started to talk about. And part of the issue is you don't need the founding team to be successful, right? But if you do, what do you need to do to make it successful? I talk about how you generate good ideas for startups, like where do really breakthrough ideas come from based on the latest science, how to pitch. And there's some really cool new evidence about sort of the weird ways you can convince people. And I'm happy to dive into that if you're interested.
Yeah.
And then finance paths. So everything from crowdfunding, where I've done a lot of work, to venture capital. And then finally, growing and hiring and how you handle all of that. And I think the whole goal is to say that almost everything, if you're just modeling yourself after Mark Zuckerberg or you know, Bill Gates or whoever, you're in trouble because those models don't fit what we're normally seeing, right? And so that's not the general model to follow, is not these guys, both because maybe they're, you know, something about them might be extraordinary, but also because they happen to get ideas that couldn't help but win when they were winning, right? Like, it would be very hard to have stopped. Once Facebook started taking off virally, it's very hard to stop that process. And right. All you could do, like, that was a train that went, like, there's a lot of rooms to make mistakes where one of your 50 businesses, one mistake would kill you. If you're Facebook and you're on this exponential curve, you have infinite money. You're going to win no matter what. Are you the best founder you could be, or did you get in the right place at the right time? So I think part of what we're trying to do is say, if you're doing this a disciplined way, these guys are not the ones to follow, right? you don't start off with that. You follow what the right path is.
Right.
So that's and I'm happy to delve into any of those topics that interest you in the time we have.
Yeah, no, definitely. you know, diving into, I mean, you mentioned, I think it was mindset.
Well, pitching and selling, and there's some interesting minds.
Yeah, pitching and selling and stuff like that. Yeah, I mean, I think kind of let's dive into that a little bit. And then maybe, I think I remember seeing some of the notes. You talk a little bit about the ideal length and the organization of a pitch deck. Because it was funny, we had just put together something a few months ago for one of our other businesses and stuff. And I was like, oh, wait, that's interesting too.
So pitching is really interesting. We actually have a lot of work where we've taken venture capitalists and angel investors, and actually people have even studied Shark Tank. Like, there's actual academic papers on Shark Tank. And so we actually have a lot of evidence about what makes people invest. And so I want to give you a weird trick to start, and then we can go into the detailed stuff.
Sure.
But the interesting trick is something called symbolic manipulation. And I don't know if did you ever see the Elizabeth Holmes Theranos, kind of any of the videos or stories about
I've seen about her. And then actually I just saw there was a documentary or something.
It's worth watching on HBO.
Yeah, I haven't watched it yet, but yeah.
And, you know, people like also the WeWork guy, Adam, you know, all of these people who are sort of successful entrepreneurs, part of the reason they're able to kind of continue these semi-scammy companies is that they found the same trick that actually we found in the academic literature, which is that investors respond to symbols of success. So because it's very, very hard... So here's the dirty secret, okay, of startups, right? Once you pass a certain quality threshold, right? Once you're like obviously pretty good, we can't tell who's going to win at the early stage. We have no idea. Like there's a cool study in Nigeria that took a whole bunch of people who made it to this big national business plan competition. So they're all really good ideas. And they used a panel of venture capitalists, a panel of academic experts, and machine learning AI. And all of them tried to predict based on the pitch decks and how they pitched, which would be successful in 6 months. Nobody was better, like 2% better than chance. Like we're talking about like poker odds, right? In terms of predicting who's going to be successful. So we don't really know. There's so much luck and other factors involved that it's really hard to tell. So one of the things investors look for is the symbols of success. So are you advertising your own capability or background? Like you've mentioned to me, and I think it's awesome. Like your successful startups, you weave that into the discussion. That's a useful way of showing that you have the capability personally to do this. You look the part, which can also be a negative too, by the way, for people of color or minorities. Like one of the reasons why there's often discrimination is they don't fit the mental model. And even though all the evidence is that female founders, black founders are at least as successful as male white founders, we find the same kind of problem ends up happening where people have fit and look for these things. And I talk about some ways in the book of getting around that. But things like showing off awards that you've won, talking about the prestigious connections you have, even having the right office space, all help create this mindset that maybe you're going to be successful because we don't know.
Right.
So looking the part of the entrepreneur can be very successful, very helpful there. So I'm not sure if you're wearing a full hoodie or not. I can't tell from the video, but yes, you are. So that's like a hoodie and possibly also a black turtleneck. So you're putting the Zuckerberg and Jobs angle. That works, right? And we actually have evidence that stuff works among founders. So so there's all kinds of interesting stuff like that I talk about in the book as well.
That's cool, and I would never thought about that at all. And so obviously with pitch, you know, making the pitch and things like that, creating that kind of symbol of success or that you're going to do well based on what you said. And then kind of what's that next process, or what they're looking for, when you're raising capital or having your pitch deck and everything.
Yep. So there is there's sort of a canonical 10 slides that you show in a pitch deck now. And you may ask why 10 slides. because that's what we do now. When I was doing my startup, you'd send out a 150-page business plan. Like, that was the thing you did. I don't know if you remember that. Like,
oh, yeah.
Late 90s. Like, that. It was mostly garbage, right? There'd be like piles of org charts that didn't mean anything and like tables full of numbers, but that's what you would do, right?
Yep.
Today, it's 10 slides. 5 years, maybe it's a VR presentation, a small musical number, a TikTok. I don't know, right? But right now, it's 10 to 12 slides. I'll send you a link. Maybe you can post it.
Sure.
I have a little video online going through the slides and going through examples on them. But it turns out, you know, you want to show these slides as setting up a hook for what you're talking about, and then stating the problem, and then giving the solution, and then showing your magic, your competitive advantage. So there's a very standard way of approaching these things.
Right.
And violating those often violates that symbolic action I was telling you about of manipulating symbols. So there's some kind of nice things you do there. And then, you know, a lot of it is really, you want to look a little bit different from what everyone's seen, but not that different. It turns out to be the key.
Huh.
So, you know, like trying to kind of conform with people's expectations, because again, they're going on gut feel.
Right.
But I'm happy to talk about details of any of these slides, or again, I'll send you a link and you can post that for your listeners and viewers.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's awesome. And I think that's super interesting, because I think our deck that we had created it's right around that 10 to 12 slides and everything
and all that. And we actually have some evidence that, like, for example, there's actually data from 40,000 pitch decks of what financiers look at most. So it turns out the number one thing they look at is the team slide is by far the most time.
Okay.
So who you are is a huge determinant of whether they fund you or not. It's part of like that means everything, right? And getting warm introductions to these investors is important as a result. So it turns out if you have a warm introduction to a venture capitalist, that means someone who knows the VC introduces the two of you. The chance of you raising capital is 14 times higher than if you have a cold introduction. So the team stuff, showing who you are, why you're the people can execute this, that's really important. It's the number one thing that venture capitalists look for in surveys is the team. And for angel investors, it's the team and the trustworthiness of the team. Are you going to run away with the money? So those are the two things that they care about most.
Like, thanks, see ya.
Yeah, exactly.
No, that's awesome. I know, because we just recently wrapped up to kind of like our advisory board and just getting ready to add that slide into the deck.
Definitely
as well.
Prestigious ties and good connections is going to get you everywhere.
Awesome. Cool. I know you talked about testing and things like that, especially if somebody's already kind of a year in and they have their business going and they're coming up with a new idea for growth and everything. And I remember you were talking about the testing, the different ideas. Can you dive into a little bit more detail in that, like how to test, what they're looking for and everything with that?
Yep. So the testing is ideally acting and doing at the same time, right? So you're not just academically sitting back, you're acting, you're trying to sell, but you're trying to think about that. So in the book, there's a list of all the assumptions businesses need to check off. So like which I borrowed from Tom Eisenman at Harvard, who has been doing some work on this. So things like, you know, what's your product differentiation strategy? What's your customer value proposition? What's your pricing? What's your market penetration strategy? So all of that in huge detail is sort of in there. And you need to go through those list of questions or a similar list, whether that's a business model canvas or the list I give in the book, doesn't matter. But you need to really spend time sitting with your partners and going through, and if you don't have partners, find friends and or advisors, and go through every question about your business. Come with a business plan. It's why, by the way, we find people who write formal business plans are three times more likely to succeed than those who don't. Not because the business plan is real, right? It's kind of fake, as you know. No business plan survives contact with the customer, as Steve Blank says. But the act of sitting there and planning helps everyone get on the same page, and you start to realize things like, I forgot about taxes, or wait, what about shipping, or how do I return things, or how much is rent going to be in that city? And you start to think about those issues you were missing. So once you go through that list, you're going to have a list of things that you are guessing that are really important. We call these key assumptions. So like, you know, like, for example, I was just talking about, you know, Rent the Runway, which is a unicorn recently founded by two women from Harvard. They rent out clothes for special occasions. When they were starting their company, the big questions were, you know, would anyone rent somebody's clothes, like used clothes? And would they do that without trying them on? And then also is important, would they return them in good enough shape that they could turn them around with low cost?
Mm, okay.
So what they did to figure this out was they conducted experiments on those. They actually did a experiment where they went to a college and they actually had racks of clothes and they had women be able to rent the clothes right from the rack. And they saw how excited they were. They actually used footage from that in their VC pitch because people were so excited.
Right.
And then they did a second study at a different college where people were allowed to see the clothes on the rack but weren't allowed to try them on, and saw how many people rented them and then how what shape they returned them in. And then finally, they only sent PDFs to people and said, you want to rent this? And so they did careful experiments while they were also learning and building out their customer base to figure out, were they right about these three key assumptions? So that's sort of the process. Start with your assumptions, build a set of testable experiments, and then find out whether you're right or wrong.
That's awesome. Yeah, no, I think those are definitely key, whatever stage you are in your business and, you know, as you're growing and implementing new ideas and everything, for sure. What I know, we kind of talked briefly off air for a minute too. Some of the things I know with the way everybody economically is right now, you know, some businesses are making it, some are having some challenges right now. What are kind of some of the insights that you've been coming across with this?
So a couple really important things, right? This is the time for entrepreneurs. I'm sure other people have told you this, but and you know, your audience this, but it actually is. And it is for a couple of reasons. One, I think we're clearly, like, entrepreneurs are more nimble at responding to disaster. They're more able to incorporate accountability. They're going to help us rebuild after all this. All of that is true. It's time to build, right? As Mark Andreessen had said, I couldn't agree more. The second thing about why it's a time for entrepreneurs, though, is that everything is now thrown up in the air, right? All of our old assumptions are broken. So all the big companies that would eat your lunch if they could are now, there's openings everywhere, right? Like, you and I are talking via video chat, you know, that I'm doing 50 a day. I'm sure you are also. We have a world now where everyone's communicating a different way. We have a world where there is going to be new need to think about, how do we relate to the police? How do we relate to society? Like, there's a lot of questions that old companies have failed to answer really well. And that creates openings. And we actually have really good evidence that, you know, entrepreneurs are the reason why there's job growth in America. They are, like, they're the, and that's not an exaggeration. Like, when we look at this, large companies or older companies net lose jobs. And if it wasn't for entrepreneurial job creation, America would lose jobs net. It is the engine for, you know, innovation. Yeah. It's the engine for communities being successful. So it really is the opportunity. And it's a really unique time because there's also the biggest gaps to move into. So I think part of this is realizing the constraints create innovation and thinking about what you've learned, what you personally know. What truth do you know that other people don't, and how to run with that one now that the big companies are distracted and are looking somewhere else? So I think it's a really good time. Now, I think it's going to be a tougher time to raise capital, but it's a really good time to raise loans. So, you know, interest rates are very low. I think I'd keep an eye on federal programs that are designed to help out, or, you know, and local programs to help out and keep entrepreneurship going. And I think I would just look for clever opportunities. It's really an amazing time and a necessary time for founders. And it's and a lot of people are going to be forced into it too, right?
Right.
Whether you want to be or not. So doing it right is probably better than doing it wrong, even if you're not, don't want to be in this situation. The only hopeful thing I can tell you is my surveys have found that entrepreneurs end up being the happiest people in the end, with both happiest for their jobs, careers, and work-family balance in the long run. So hopefully that will come out for even the worst of this as well.
Phenomenal. Just with a few minutes left, what's one thing you're like, okay, I was hoping Josh was going to ask me this, but he didn't. What's one thing you're like, all right, I just really need to share this with everybody?
Oh, it's tough when you ask an academic this question. It's like, I can give you a 90-minute lecture.
Yeah, I know. Okay, in a couple minutes.
I'm just kidding. I'm not going to do that to you. It's fine. I do have a Coursera course, which is free if you guys want to watch it at some point. It's with a bunch of my colleagues. I mean, I think I would just say, the message for overall for the unicorn shadow, which is that you don't have to feel that just because you don't look like the founder that you think about, like the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world and people like that, or, you know, the founders of Google or whatever successful company you have in your mind, you know, Travis from Uber or whatever it is, that is both not bad and may actually be good, because a lot of these people are not modeling the kind of behavior that creates strong companies, strong communities, or success. So that's my main advantage, is like almost everything you're learning, like from that kind of wisdom approach, you should feel free to question it. You should question the facts of my book too, obviously. I'm an academic. I want you to push things forward, but that you shouldn't be discouraged. I think too many people are looking for role models in the wrong role models. And one of the things I like about, you know, you're bringing a lot of people, you're sharing a lot of experience. I think seeing a diversity of role models and people is really important, and paying attention to the facts as well as and evidence as well as sort of gut is important too.
Phenomenal. Where can people grab your book now that it's available?
So I think it's actually, I don't know, a week or maybe, I don't know when this is airing.
Yeah,
it's down already.
Yeah.
Any bookstore. I also have a site, Unicorn Shadow with a dash, that I'll also send you the link to along with the YouTube that has lots of resources. But you can buy it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. It's everything, but I think it's not in stores, so it's like order online.
Okay.
Any source that you want. And I have lots of links and other information on the website, including the references I use.
Super. Guys, I hope you guys are really taking notes, listening to what Ethan has to say today. Whatever stage you are right now in your business, wherever you are right now during everything that's been going on, make sure you rewind, listen, watch this again. He's dropped so many amazing insights, things that you can take and apply right now in your business, different strategies, different ways to look at things, as well as grab his new book, The Unicorn Shadow, out now. A quick read, but it's packed full of amazing insights to help you and also challenge you. And so get out, check it out. And the different notes, the videos and everything that Ethan's mentioned are right down here in the show notes below. So click on those and dive into those as well. So Ethan, really appreciate your time today, an honor to have you on the show, and just super excited for all the information that you were able to share.
Thank you for having me. It was a real honor for me as well.
I am Josh Felber. You are watching Making Bank. Get out and be extraordinary.
Thank you for listening to Making Bank. If you have enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. And sharing is caring. Follow Josh Felber on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram for more. You can also listen to Making Bank on Amazon Alexa, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and watch on Apple TV, Success Thinkers Network, Amazon Fire, and YouTube.